For those of us in the area that's been hit by Hurricane Sandy, it may seem hard to believe that there's still a presidential race going on. Nevertheless, on Tuesday, millions of Americans will be heading to the polls. Joining us now to recap the last few days on the campaign trail and where the candidates will be this final weekend is MSNBC host and editor-at-large for The Nation, Chris Hayes. His book, Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy, is published by Crown. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hi, Chris.
Well, it's great to be back.
And by the way, before we get started, I should mention that officials here in New York City and in New Jersey are making arrangements for voting on Election Day. And listeners can find information about that on WNYC.org and on our politics website. It's afreecountry.org. Chris, you're located here in New York. How have you been coping with the storm and its aftermath?
Well, we're very lucky. I've been joking that in Park Slope, our smug liberal self-satisfaction protects us from the elements. But we were fine in Park Slope. That portion of the city got very, very lucky. It's on high ground. There were some downed trees. But I've biked around quite a bit. I've been biking through Lower Manhattan, obviously, where you guys are. It's pretty intense to see. My folks are without power up in the Bronx. And Red Hook, which is just a few miles from where I live, obviously is going through a really rough time. And I haven't seen as much coverage of that, but there's a lot of public housing there, and obviously they took a lot of water there. So it's bizarre. It's interesting to see, and I remember reading reports about this in the wake of Katrina, that, you know, the city, even amidst all of the devastation there was in Katrina, there were pockets of the city, particularly areas that were elevated, that didn't see that much devastation. And it's strange how vast the difference is just within the city itself, between those areas that are essentially leveled to the ground or completely annihilated, like, say, Breezy Point, and, you know, the Upper West Side or Park Slope that are basically business as usual.
And now to politics. We got the latest jobs numbers this morning. 171,000 jobs were added in October. How much of an impact do you think that will have on the campaign at this point? As far as the Obama campaign is concerned, does every little bit help?
Yeah, I think at the margins it probably does. I think that the bigger sigh of relief that probably came from Chicago's, you know, where the campaign headquarters are located, came because it wasn't a really bad number. I think some hugely below expectation number would have become a real central campaign talking point for the Romney campaign for the last 4 days. This is a pretty good jobs report. In some ways, more important than these numbers were the revisions for the last 2 months, which were up quite a bit. And so I think that this fits largely with the trend that we've seen and the story that the president has been telling in his bid for reelection, which is that there's a lot more work to be done, but that the things are moving in the right direction.
And but do you think this kind of information actually sways people who are still undecided?
You know, I don't know how, to be honest, at this point, 4 days before the election, I don't know if we have a particularly precise grasp, both in the political science literature, in the world of polling, and certainly in the world of punditry, about we have a very precise grasp on who this very small pool of people who were undecided 4 days before the election are. I mean, the polling right now, when you're seeing polling that says 50%, 48%, that is suggesting that, you know, you're basically at what, you know, people have decided, because there's going to be a few percentage points that are lost to third-party candidates or write-in votes or things like that. I'm just not convinced there's much convincing left to be done at this point. I think at this point people broadly made up their minds, and barring some hugely, hugely anomalous event that comes from outside, or, you know, like a jobs report in which we've lost 500,000 jobs or something like that, I don't see that there's a lot of wiggle room in the electorate at this point.
Well, as you said, the polls indicate that President Obama and Governor Romney are neck and neck nationally. But as of late last night on 538, Nate Silver was giving the president an 80% chance of winning. He even made a bet with Joe Scarborough.
Yeah, I mean, look, I've found the sort of Nate Silver backlash a bit amusing to behold. I think part of it is just the fact that at one level, the source of much of people's interest in what pundits are doing, such as myself, I should include myself in that category, is the elemental fact about human life, which is that we want to know the future and cannot know the future. And human beings have been coping with that since, you know, the first shaman figures, you know, red tea leaves or grain or Delphic oracles or things like that. So I think Nate has brought a tremendous amount of rigor and has, as rigorously as one could possibly, used the data to try to come up with a probabilistic prediction. And I think what Nate is saying is basically what everyone else is saying, which is that if you just aggregate the state polling data, don't do anything fancy, just average it all out, you find the president has a small but consistent and significant and apparently durable lead in a sufficient number of states to get him to 270 electoral votes. It's not rocket science. I mean, it's possible that state-based polling in a bunch of those states is systematically wrong for some reason. It's possible that something somewhat remarkable happens in the next 4 days. But I think the odds are in favor that those are unlikely circumstances, that the president, based on all the data we have, has a small but significant and durable lead.
In the Electoral College, not necessarily in the popular vote. We may see something similar to Gore Bush here.
That's right. I mean, I think it's certainly possible that there is a split between the two. And I think that that possibility in some ways is perhaps elevated by the devastation of Sandy and the fact that I was reading today one estimate that as many as 300,000 Obama votes could be lost just in the New York area alone, which is a significant number of votes if it's a very close election, the popular vote. It is possible. I think there is some reason to believe, and Nate has made this argument, and I've also looked at some other folks who I think have been fairly persuasive, that if there's a mismatch between the state-based polling and the national polling, the state-based polling might be giving you a more accurate picture, in which case we would expect to see the president with a very narrow popular vote win. And I would also note that the national tracking numbers seem to be moving slightly in the president's direction over the last 3 or 4 days, which may suggest that the divergence between state polling numbers and national popular vote polling numbers is diminishing as we head towards Election Day.
Well, Gore Bush went to the courts, and both campaigns are fully staffed with lawyers. Should the voting in the battleground states go awry or be incredibly close, you think that's likely to happen on Tuesday? Can we expect a lot of vote recounts in the days following the election?
Yes. I mean, I think, again, it all depends on the outcome. You know, there are triggers in the states that are statutory triggers about when what margin automatically triggers a recount. And then there are petitions that one can, you know, lawsuits one can use in terms of jostling for recounts and questioning recounts and questioning which votes are counted in recounts. If it is close, particularly if we have a situation in which, say, a not ridiculous scenario, which is that the contest comes down to who won Ohio, and Ohio is within half a percentage point, then we're going to see a recount, and we're going to see a tremendous amount of litigation and jostling. And I think, you know, Republicans won that battle through just brass knuckle force, essentially, in Florida in 2000. And I think both sides will be prepared for that. And I worry a little bit about, given the partisan nature of the country, given the fact that I think there's already been seeds sown among conservatives to view the president as illegitimate and a possible victory as illegitimate, you know, you do worry about that. Now, that problem diminishes quite a bit if the number of states that are won clear an electoral bar. That means that it doesn't come down to just one state. And so that's also possible based on where the state polling data is right now.
Well, I suspect that we're going to see a lot more recounts when it comes to congressional races.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, people should remember the Minnesota race in 2008 between incumbent Norm Coleman and Democratic challenger Al Franken, now Senator Franken. That was an incredibly close race. I want to say under 1,000 votes. I don't have the number on the top of my head. And was contested. It was recounted and then contested and drawn out for a long time by the Republicans. I mean, every last play they could make. And what it meant was they denied a filibuster-proof majority because Al Franken was the 60th Democrat in the Senate. So they denied that to the Democrats for the first several months of the Obama administration, which was a period of a lot of legislating. That's when the Recovery Act was passed and so forth. So there were real political costs to how long it took until Al Franken could be seated senator. And, you know, in the Constitution, both houses get to say who they seat. And so, you know, we may see a number of cases, both in the House and the Senate, that are similar.
Now, the president was back on the campaign trail yesterday in Wisconsin, and Mitt Romney has added a stop in Pennsylvania this weekend. So are those states still in play?
You know, I don't think so. I mean, I think, look, Wisconsin, I think, is close but a long shot, but I think could legitimately consider it a swing state, partly because of Paul Ryan and the ticket, partly because of the fact that Wisconsin has had a very anomalous several years politically between the election of Scott Walker and the counter-mobilization against Scott Walker and the recall elections and then the recall election of Scott Walker, the Senate recall elections, the recall election of Scott Walker, that is a state that is in a real state of flux politically, and Paul Ryan's on the ticket, and so I can imagine that that is within striking distance, although the polls show the president consistently ahead. Pennsylvania is one of these places where every 4 years there's some talk that Republicans going to make a play in Pennsylvania. John McCain campaigned in Pennsylvania, I think in Scranton, on the weekend before his campaign, before Election Day, and ended up losing it by 10 points. I think the demographics of Pennsylvania, its longstanding voting behavior, the aggregate polling all suggests that Pennsylvania will go for Barack Obama. And the reason that you're seeing ads being run by the Romney campaign there, and I believe also in Minnesota, is that they have a lot of money to spend. And someone compared it today to an onside kick in football, which is that it's, you know, if you're behind, you want to take some chances, and they have enough money that it's not a huge loss for them to see if they can move the numbers there a bit with some late advertising.
Chris Hayes is editor-at-large of The Nation, host of Up with Chris Hayes on MSNBC. His latest book, Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy, published by Crown. We'll continue this conversation, this campaign update, in a time when the campaign seems to have been largely forgotten because of the situation we're facing here in the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy. We'll continue right after this. We're back with Christopher Hayes, whose latest book is Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy, published by Crown. We are taking a look at where the election campaign stands right now in the last few days before we vote on Tuesday. A lot was made, Chris, of another Chris Christie, who gave the keynote address at the Republican National Convention 2 months ago. By the way, a convention that was curtailed by another hurricane. Yep. And there was a lot of talk earlier this week about his praise of both President Obama and the federal response to Sandy. Were you surprised that a governor whose state has been devastated would have some kind words for the president? Isn't it in his best interest to get as much support for his state as he can?
Yeah, I thought the reaction to it was out of proportion to what actually happened. And I think in some ways the reaction to it was so out of proportion because Republicans have succeeded in creating an expectation and norm of total implacable opposition to the president at all times across all issues that is not the norm in American politics but has become the norm. And so what Chris Christie was doing wasn't out of the ordinary. You know, that's kind of what you do. You do, you know, when there's a disaster, the president goes to the area that's been struck by the disaster. There's almost always some kind of, you know, photo op between the president and the governor and some local officials. And I think, you know, I think Christie was saying that he thought what the federal government was offering was good. And I think if he didn't think that, he would say it wasn't. I mean, it's also true that the incentives align for Chris Christie, both because he'll be partly dependent on the federal government to get him the resources that he needs to rebuild New Jersey, and also because he'll be up for election next year in a state that Obama's going to win by a fairly significant margin. And so, that's clearly playing some role, but I wasn't surprised by it. It seems to me that actually it's fairly standard practice.
Well, do you think it undermines Governor Romney's argument that the president hasn't been bipartisan enough?
Yeah,
do you think voters actually pay attention to this sort of thing?
Again, it's a little unclear the pool of people deciding at this point, you know, how much effect it could possibly have on them. I mean, yes, the optics of it do undermine that, but again, do the optics of that undermine the, you know, does that erase the fact that, you know, we've had years basically of Republican opposition and very little quote bipartisanship in American politics outside of the realm of foreign policy, I should note.
Have you read the argument being put forward by David Brooks and some others that if Obama is reelected, there'll be Republican resistance to enacting any of his proposals, but if Romney is elected as a kind of a center-right moderate, the Democrats are more likely to support his proposals?
Oh, well, I think that's here's one key bit of polling data that explains a lot about American politics. If you poll Democrats, would you rather your elected representatives, quote, stand on principle or compromise to get things done? I believe that's the wording of the poll. A majority of Democrats say compromise to get things done, and a majority of Republicans say stand on principle. So the bases of the two parties, the membership of the two parties, have different dispositions towards compromise. And the Republican Party has united itself around the fact that it will not compromise with a Democratic president for anything, really. And I don't think that's the case in the other direction. I mean, one way to look at this is to look at how the Democrats responded to the first signature domestic policy legislative initiative of President George W. Bush, a man who had been elected with a popular vote loss and in the most contested and ugly legal battle in recent electoral history. There was massive cooperation on No Child Left Behind. Teddy Kennedy was the co-sponsor in the Senate, and it was a broadly bipartisan agenda. Compare that to Barack Obama winning a victory that was far more of a mandate than George W. Bush had, and amidst a period of genuine national crisis and a policy in the Recovery Act that was broadly seen across the kind of technocratic spectrum of experts as necessary, and the president could barely muster three votes from Republicans in the Senate. So you see in those two examples that there's a different disposition in the two parties in how they are going to approach being in the opposition or being in control.
Could Hurricane Sandy cause Americans to rethink what the role of the federal government is? In addition to the devastation in our area, there was also a major blizzard in West Virginia and Tennessee. Although many states have received FEMA aid for different natural disasters in the past, the fact that this is New York, which many parts of the country are rather ambivalent about, does that have any effect? We're not Oklahoma, which is the state that gets the most federal disaster aid.
Yeah, I think that disasters can be clarifying in that respect, insofar as they lay bare, they kind of strip away all of the wrappings of society and civilization and governance, and they expose the struts and beams and the barest foundation of it, which is how do we hold up this thing that we have, which is American society, and all of the quite remarkable flourishing that it produces. It's basically based on a whole bunch of public goods we take for granted. It's based on a lot of nameless and much maligned bureaucrats, civil servants, frontline workers, first responders. The subway system is the perfect example of this. It's something that, you know, essentially is the foundation for what is the highest concentration of economic activity anywhere in the Western Hemisphere, maybe the world. And you take it away and all that goes away. And who are the people that make that happen? They're the unionized workers of the Transit Workers Union, who are right now in tunnels up to their waist in water, pumping water out and trying to get the system running again.
Hasn't Mitt Romney been forced to backtrack on things he said about FEMA during the campaign?
Yeah, he has backtracked. I mean, what's been so interesting about these budgetary three-card money that the Romney campaign has played is they basically said, we're going to cut spending, but we won't tell you what we're going to cut. And then anytime someone says, well, you said you're going to cut this, I say, no, we're not going to cut that. That's something you like. We're not going to cut that. But all that means is to keep their promises, something else is going to be cut by more. So when they say, no, we're not going to cut FEMA. We're not going to outsource it to private companies or send it back to the states. Obviously, we're not going to do that. It means that if he's going to keep his budget targets, then something like basic research is going to be cut by more. And then when the president criticizes Mitt Romney in the first debate in Denver over possibly cutting Pell Grants, which is something that his running mate Paul Ryan's budgets have done, and they've cut them quite dramatically. He says, no, of course we don't want to cut Pell Grants. Pell Grants are great. Well, if you don't cut Pell Grants, then some other part of the budget is good. So the more you take things off the table, the less likely it is that you're actually serious about what kind of cuts you say you're gonna make, or the hatchet is going to fall hardest and hardest and more severely on those parts of the budget, like, say, Medicaid, that benefit the least politically powerful constituencies.
Before Sandy hit, climate change wasn't an issue that was talked about on the campaign trail by either candidate. And now that seems to have changed, especially since New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg endorsed Obama yesterday, specifically citing the president's stance on climate change. There was a line in Mitt Romney's acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention in August that mocked President Obama for failing to halt the rise of the seas, as Obama, the candidate, had promised in 2008.
Yeah, I think that moment was a shocking, embarrassing moment for both Romney and everyone who was in that hall laughing, and I think will be viewed with just complete disbelief by future generations.
But doesn't seem to have much of an impact on this election. And,
well, it doesn't, and I think that what is happening and what will continue to happen is, the political problem around mobilizing people for climate is that you have to make policy now to avoid problems in the future. And that's always a difficult thing for any democracy to do.
Now,
not impossible. We've done it with, say, the ozone. We did an amazing thing with the ozone. But the question is, at what point can you mobilize sufficient political power to make those choices?
Now, despite the storm, there's been some politics as usual. The Romney campaign has been running an ad that infers that Chrysler is shipping Jeep production and the jobs that go with it to China. We have a clip of it. Let's take a listen.
Obama took GM and Chrysler into bankruptcy and sold Chrysler to Italians who are going to build Jeeps in China. Mitt Romney will fight for every American job.
I'm Mitt Romney, and I approve this message.
Is the Romney campaign trying to reframe the candidate's opposition to the auto bailout with that kind of ad?
The Romney campaign recognizes they have a huge problem, which is it's extremely difficult to win the presidency without winning Ohio. In Ohio is a state that's seen the unemployment rate drop lower and more rapidly than national figures. And a big part of that has to do with the auto rescue, which has saved probably in the neighborhood of 150,000 jobs concretely, that we can nail that, 160,000 jobs, including some jobs making Jeeps around Toledo. There's actually UAW workers making Jeeps who called up their factory and be like, am I wrong?
Chrysler's run an ad that said it's not true.
Yeah, Chrysler's running out and it's not true. And the head of GM, which isn't directly implicated by the ad, the head of GM tweeted at Donald Trump, who was raising the issue on Twitter yesterday, "You are full of something I can't say on the air."
And we appreciate you not saying it.
it's pretty ridiculous, and I think it shows that they have a huge political problem. They have not been able to budge the numbers in Ohio in the polling to get them over their small the deficit they have, which is between probably 2 and 5 points.
Chris, we've run out of time, and I don't want to embarrass you by asking you who you think is going to win the election. But I will tell listeners that you are an editor-at-large at The Nation, host of Up with Chris Hayes on MSNBC, and author of Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy, published by Crown.